Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today went from working on a children's hospital ward to seeing his debut novel, Before I Go to Sleep, become a phenomenal international bestseller and a Hollywood blockbuster. The New York Times described him as an out-of-nowhere literary sensation. Well, he may have come from out of nowhere, but it's clear he's on his way to a stellar literary career, as evidenced in his next book, Second Life, and the seriousness with which the book world is taking him. S.J. Watson, Steve Watson, thanks so much for joining me here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Out of nowhere, that's a bit harsh. Stourbridge, wasn't it?
It was out of Stourbridge, yeah. No, Stourbridge isn't quite nowhere, but yes.
Tell us about early times in Stourbridge.
Oh, early times in Stourbridge. Yeah, well, yeah, it's funny because Stourbridge felt like somewhere... It's an interesting place. I don't really go back anymore. In fact, I don't go back anymore, actually. But I don't look back on it through... rose-tinted spectacles. I'm not quite sure what they're tinted with. It felt like somewhere I wanted to escape, but I think that was for a number of reasons, and I don't want to sound ungrateful for what Stourbridge gave me, although it's difficult for me to identify what that was. I grew up in a working-class background, I suppose. My father worked for the local steelworks, which was turned into a shopping centre in the first Thatcher recession, sort of 79 to 83, I think it was. And so lots of people in the area kind of lost their jobs. So it was one of those places that completely changed during my early teenage years, I suppose, which, although maybe I wasn't really aware of it at the time, was perhaps formative, but I'm not really sure.
Mm. And then you escaped off to university. Mm. What did you study and how did you get to that point? What was it that was driving you?
Well, it's funny because when I was, you know, the kind of cliched question that people ask you when you're young about what do you want to do when you grow up? And I always wanted to be a writer. I always wanted to be a novelist. It was always my ambition for as long as I remember. I wasn't a particularly bookish family, but my mom read to me from a very young age. And so I always loved reading and stories and wanted to be a writer. But then, I don't know, I spoke to somebody, my father perhaps, or maybe it was a careers teacher, I'm not sure, who said, and I announced this plan of literary domination or just to get a book published. And they said, you know, well, it's not a very stable career. Maybe you should do something else instead. And for better or for worse, I took that advice to heart and decided that I also enjoyed science. So I thought what I'll do is I'll go and sort of specialise in science. Because I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I thought if I do a physics degree, that leaves a lot of doors open for you, I suppose. You know, that means there's lots of you know, you can go on and be many things with a physics degree in theory. So I studied physics as a kind of second best, really. I didn't really want to study literature, which I look back and think that's quite an odd decision to make. And occasionally I'll think even now, maybe I should go and do an open university degree and actually study literature. But I seem to be doing okay. So I did physics and then kind of decided, I developed an interest, I suppose, in the medical aspects of physics, the medical aspects of science. And so I ended up as an audiologist, yeah. Ended up as an audiologist makes it sound like it just happened one day, but now I studied to be one, but yeah. Mm.
So what does an audiologist do, actually?
Well, it's a clinician, so I worked with patients, but I wasn't medically trained, so I wasn't able to make diagnoses and stuff. So it's an interesting kind of grey area between someone who just presses the buttons and does the tests, and then I was responsible, I suppose, for analysing the test results and presenting findings to doctors, basically
of hearing
and balance. But I specialised towards the second half of my career. I specialised with hearing impaired children. So I was, people who maybe had a concern about their child's hearing would be referred to the service in which I worked. And then I was responsible for trying to determine whether they did have a hearing problem and to what extent it was. And then fitting with hearing aids or so on to try and help as much as possible. So it was that kind of journey. It's every aspect except for the medical, I suppose. Mm.
So while all that's going on, and here you are, you're working in a children's ward, you're interacting with kids and their parents, the very dark life of Before You Go to Sleep is somewhere germinating in the back of your mind.
I don't think it's that dark. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, not particularly that book, but yeah, well, I've always written to a greater or lesser extent. I mean, I've been through some quite long periods where I didn't write anything, or certainly not very much. But, you know, even then, I suppose, I was keeping a notebook with me and jotting down little ideas and little titles and paragraphs and even chapters or something. So it's always been there. But then as I kind of moved through my career, I suppose, in the health service, and I was deputy head of a very large department in Southeast London, and the next logical career step would be to become head of a department. And I just, I jokingly refer to it as my mini midlife crisis. I was sort of approaching 40 and just thinking, actually, you know, my ambition was always to write books. It was never to be head of a department in a hospital. So, you know, what am I actually, you know, I suppose I thought if I wanted to do this, if I want to be a writer or write or be a successful writer, or however you want to define success, if I want to have a book published, I suppose, I actually need to make some sacrifices and decide, you know, I can't do both. I can't concentrate on both things. And so I decided that I would, for 5 years, I would concentrate on the writing. As for the darkness, I don't know. I sort of slightly resist categorising myself as someone who's drawn to dark things. But I suppose if you look at the music I've always loved and the books I've always enjoyed and stuff, maybe I do enjoy darkness.
What's the music?
Well, you know, I'm much more likely to be listening to, I don't know. On my way here this morning on my iPhone, I was listening to Hole and Nirvana. That was a bit of a nostalgia trip because I was in Seattle a few weeks ago, so I was obviously thinking a lot about Nirvana and that. But that kind of, I'm much more likely to still be listening to that than Justin Bieber. Although, you know, at the right time, but I can do a bit of Bieber as well.
So you gave yourself 5 years. You went part-time at the hospital. And how did you take the writing forward?
Yeah, I made the decision that I wanted to go part time, and so I asked my boss if I could go part time, and he said no. When I tell this story, I make it sound as I rather grandly stormed out and slammed the door behind me, said, "Well, I'm going anyway," but I didn't. I just kind of like skulked away, and then coincidentally and very luckily, I saw a job advertised in the same field in London with people I knew, because it's a fairly small profession, audiology. And it was 3 days a week. And it was also much more junior. So I went I applied for the job and was successful. And I went from being a full-time deputy head of service to part-time, quite junior clinician, which was great. Not so great for the bank balance, but it was still okay, you know. But it meant I just had all this energy, much more energy and mental energy as much as anything to actually write. And then I think it actually was the week in which I handed in my notice and to prepare for this change in my job, I saw an advertisement for the Faber Academy, and that's, as you probably know, it was the first time a publisher had done it was a 6-month course that we're advertising. It was the first time a publisher had done a 6-month writing course, and I thought that would be a really good thing to apply for, because I thought it would give me a bit more focus in this. I didn't want to sort of like take this cut in wage, go part-time, and then sit around watching daytime television. Mm-hmm. I thought it would be a really good way of focusing me if I was doing a course. So I applied to go on the course, and I was successful. We're now in January 2009, and everything kind of came. I'm not a great believer in fate, but everything did seem to sort of come together. So I started my new job in the January, and then the course started in the February. So it was definitely, it marked a new, if you'll forgive the pun, a new chapter in my life. And yeah. I really decided I would throw everything into the writing. So, for example, I would meet people at parties or whatever, and that cliched question, but the one that everybody asks, which is, you know, what do you do for a living? And I would always say, yeah, I'm a writer. And people would say, "Oh, what have you had written? Or what have you written? Or what have you had published?" And I'd be like, "Nothing yet." But you know, but I made the decision to call myself a writer. Before, I think you have to do that if you're an aspiring novelist. You have to call yourself a writer and take yourself seriously as a writer before anybody else will. So yeah, so my friends used to tease me and say, "Well, of course you've gone part time now." And I used to say, "Well, you know, actually I've got two jobs. It's just that one of them doesn't pay," which, as it turned out, not to be the case. But
In fact, the Faber Academy course, 6 months, and that's sort of developing the novel. And that novel was, in fact, your first book, Before I Go to Sleep.
Yeah, it was. I'd been working on a different book for some time before that, and one of my options, as I was about to start the course at Faber, was to take that failed book and try and finish it and try and get it, you know, on its feet. And working. But I decided fairly late on, actually, that I would probably learn much more from the course if I took in a brand new project that I was working at from scratch. Because the structure of the course, you know, week one was idea generation, and week two was making a start, and week three was characters. I don't remember the details, but it kind of took you through. And so I thought I'd probably learn much more if I was working on something brand new. Mm. But then it was a case of, well, what? So I scoured my notebooks and nothing really leapt out at me. But then I read an obituary of a man called Henry Malaison, who's mentioned in the back of the book, who is a man who suffered very severe amnesia for most of his adult life, following an operation to help him with his epilepsy. And I just read this obituary and was really struck by this image of somebody towards the end of their life, sort of in their 70s or 80s perhaps, whose most recent memory is from the age of 25, and what it must be like to try and exist with no real knowledge of who you are or how you came to be where you are, and being surrounded by people who know you very well. He lived in a nursing home, and the obituary described how the same doctor would come and see him every week, I think, or even every day, I'm not sure. But and so she felt that she knew him very, very well, and yet even at the end of his life he didn't know who she was. So he had a vague memory, apparently, that he may have met her at high school. And that kind of really struck me, of this being marooned, I suppose, and being taken out of your life and not really having any sense of your own autobiography. So I thought the opening scene from the book that became Before I Go to Sleep appeared, really, when I read the obituary. And when it came to time to start the course started on the Wednesday, and on the Monday, 2 days beforehand, I thought I'd get a bit of a head start. So I wrote what became chapter one. So it was all very kind of sudden.
Because it is so, so effective. I mean, you're really with this woman who looks in the mirror and sees herself and can't quite believe what she's seen, because she is expecting her younger self. And here is this much, much older woman. I mean, I get that fright in the mornings quite a lot. But she genuinely was a lot of years behind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the image that first struck me. And if you fast forward by, I don't know, 9 months or 10 months or something, when I first showed it to the person who was now my agent, Claire, I remember she said to me, "So where are you in this book?" Which I think is perhaps something that she asks everybody who presents her with a new manuscript. And I very grandly said, "I'm not in this book at all. It's completely not autobiographical." But it's funny, because now I can look back at it and think I'm on every single page virtually. And that's one of the things. I think I was also starting to, you know, look in the mirror and see this kind of bald, slightly wrinkly person who I think, well, how did I get to this? You know, when did that happen? And also a friend of mine said, you know, he said, you know, you always end up shaving your father. By which, of course, hopefully you realise he meant, you know, the person you see in the mirror, in the shaving mirror, ends up being the person, you know, you turn into your dad. So I think I was thinking of all those things, ageing and that sort of stuff. And that's, I always say all writing has, or even, you know, fiction, it still has to be autobiographical, because there's a reason that that story, that person, that obituary triggered something in my head that I then thought I want to turn this into a novel.
Do you have any memory issues yourself?
No, I don't think so. I have a terrible problem with names sometimes, but then I speak to everybody. I meet a lot of people, and I have that slightly embarrassing thing where I meet a lot of people and often people know who I am, and so I have that thing where I don't always remember people's names. I shouldn't perhaps admit that. I've considered spreading a rumour that I do have a memory problem. That's why I'm so rude.
There are a couple of names that you're unlikely to forget: Nicole Kidman, Ridley Scott, being a couple of them, and that's of course because it was made into a film.
Yes, I mean, my biggest ambition when I was writing the book was that. You know, I suppose dim and distantly, I thought maybe I could get it published. But really, it was just I wanted to write a book that somebody who I wasn't related to said was pretty good. So I never even dared to think that one day I'd be stood in a studio in Twickenham with Nicole Kidman in costume, pretending to be someone who I'd invented. It was a very surreal experience.
And from everything I've seen that you write about it, she really understood the character. I mean, she really got it.
Yeah, she did. There was one moment, you know, there was one moment particularly I remember that struck home. It was because I went, they couldn't really keep me away, unfortunately. I turned up at least two or three times a week, I think, to watch them film. I think I maybe got slightly... I had my own chair towards the end. And I think at first they thought I was there to criticise and to say, well, that shouldn't be quite like that, and you haven't quite done that right. But actually, I was just there like a kid in a sweet shop, just excited. So I was there when they were filming one particular scene, and I'd read the script for that day, and something about it wasn't quite right, but I couldn't put my finger on it. And it wasn't a script I'd written. I didn't write the script. It was the director, Rowan Joffe, had written the script as well. But that same part of what they were shooting that day, Nicole Kidman, kept stumbling over. She couldn't quite get it right. And eventually she called Rowan over and said, it's because she wouldn't say that. And she made a different suggestion. And as soon as she explained why Christine, the character, wouldn't say what was written in the script, she was totally right. And the whole scene fell into place. And also, I remember thinking, you know this character better than me now. And in a weird kind of way, it was almost like saying goodbye to Christine, the character, because it did feel like, yeah, she's Nicole's now. She can have her.
What about writing as a woman? Because not only in Before I Go to Sleep, but also in your next book, Second Life, you write as a woman.
Yeah, it was never one of those things I sort of sat down and decided that that would be my thing. It didn't even really feel like a particularly brave decision. When I read, ironically, because since it was a man who died and whose obituary I read and it triggered the book, before the first book, it was a woman who I imagined looking in a mirror and seeing her own reflection. And so I toyed with the idea very briefly of writing the book, from a male point of view, but never really very seriously. And I always knew it had to be in the first person. So that was kind of the basis of the decision, really. And I think a lot of the time people become very entrenched, I think, in the idea that men and women are very, very different, and it must be the hugest leap for me as a man to think myself into the shoes of a woman or the head of a woman, perhaps. But it never really felt... I think, you know, if I was writing a book about an astronaut, this is perhaps... I don't know if this is going to work, but if I was writing a book about an astronaut in the first person, I would have to try and imagine how an astronaut would feel, what it might be like to go into space, to, you know, to gaze out on our planet and so on and so on. So that's what a novelist does. And actually, writing from a woman's point of view is I never found it that difficult. I mean, I think there's
even
a lot of overlap.
To the sex scenes.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, that was something I had to be more... I suppose I had to be more careful.
But I mean, you absolutely got them right. But that's astounds me, that yeah. you, as a gay man, writing a straight woman having sex with a man, is it extraordinary?
Yeah, I mean, maybe my sexuality means that I found it less embarrassing to think, or maybe to think myself into those situations with a female perspective, or maybe I was, you know, I've got a lot of female friends, and while I never sat down and interviewed them... because that would just be too weird, you know. You talk and you gossip and you share, I suppose. So I had all that to draw on. And also I was very lucky because three of my four editors were women, and my agent's a woman, and my mom's obviously a woman, and she was one of my first readers. So there were lots of people who would pick me up on things if I'd got things slightly not quite right.
Is that whole sort of, I don't want to call them support staff, but for instance, your agent is the wonderful Claire Comville.
Yeah.
And I just wonder how important that relationship and the relationship with your various editors actually is.
Hugely. It's been a really interesting part of the journey for me to sort of learn just how, because you write a novel and it's a very solitary experience. Obviously, you're in a room by yourself with imaginary people, and you have to work very hard and get things as well as... But then you hand it over to other people, and then other people who are in the industry and I suppose are looking at it, even if it's, quote, literary fiction, are still looking at it with a commercial eye, I suppose. You know, is it worth publishing this, and how many of these can we sell, and will it catch on, and, you know, will the French like it or whatever, you know? So... It's a very kind of exposing thing to have created something and then to hand it over. And so they need to be people you really trust. It's about trust, I think. Mm. I've got to trust people. And Claire is someone who I trust absolutely implicitly. I mean, all of my editors too, but particularly Claire. She's not my first reader. My mum usually reads it first. But she has no critical. I could write anything and she'd think it was great. So Claire's the first person who will come back at me and say, that bit doesn't quite work. This bit's great. I would change that if I were you. I mean, it's still my book, and I could reject all of this advice, but it's about weighing that up, I suppose.
You talked about literary fiction, and genre is an interesting question, because really you could call these books, both of them, thrillers.
Mm. Yes. It's an interesting one, isn't it? I always mentally put literary fiction in inverted commas. Because I have a problem with this idea that books can either be really well written and have good characters and be interesting and using interesting language and be ambitious in that, or they can have a good story and be entertaining. And it feels like there still is this kind of snobbishness, I suppose. And certainly what I'm aiming to do, what my ambition is with my work, is to write books that are hopefully well written and use interesting language and all of that, but are also tell a story and are page turners. I don't think those two things need to be mutually exclusive. But I think it's, and certainly as a writer, I don't sit, particularly with Before I Go to Sleep, I didn't sit down to write a psychological thriller. And in fact, it was quite a shock when Claire read it and said, "You do know this is a psychological thriller, don't you?" Because I didn't, because I don't think in terms of genre. Certainly when I write, and not even really when I read. I think it's an artificial construct, I think, that I can totally understand why the publishing industry has to have it. You know, it, for no other reason than they need to know which shelf to put it on in the bookstore. But I do find it quite an interesting thing. I get sent quite a lot of manuscripts, you know, with a view to those little quotes, the blurbs that they put on the front of, you know, books. And quite often I sent very early manuscripts where there isn't a jacket yet. It's just literally the Word document, pretty much. And then sometime later, I'll see the book on the shelf and I'll say, oh God, they've packaged that as a psychological thriller, or they've put it out as a crime novel, or they've put it out as whatever. And it's interesting to read books that you haven't got that preconceived idea about because you haven't seen a jacket, and to see how it could be slotted into, often they can be slotted into many different categories.
Now, your first book won several awards in the sort of crime area, the National Book Award for Crime Thriller of the Year, for instance. And so that book was written really, I suppose, with hope, and your second perhaps in expectation.
Or
I mean,
fear. Yeah.
Your second book, Second Life, also came out of something real. You had been reading somebody's blog.
Yeah, it's funny though. Second Life had a much more gradual gestation period, if you like. I can't really pinpoint the moment at which I didn't have a kind of a revelation of this is what I want to write about. It kind of grew. But if I think about it and I can trace back the beginning of it, it was, I think, this person's blog. This is a long time ago when I read this. It was well before I wrote Before I Go to Sleep, even. And I would read this person's, and it was back then, or the blog that she chosen to write anyway, was really an online journal. So she would write about her feelings and her thoughts and her day-to-day activity, you know, and opera she'd been to or new restaurants that she tried out and things like that. And I used to read it a few times a week. Because really, she was an aspiring novelist, so there was that, and as was I at the time. But it was also very beautifully written, and she would talk about feminism and politics and lots of things that interested me. But a couple of things, I think. First of all, I sort of noticed over time that I'd started to think of myself as a friend of this person, almost. And then I kind of realised that actually I'm not this person's friend. I've never met them. We possibly wouldn't get on even if we did meet. And secondly, it was very kind of one way. She knew nothing about me. And I suppose that also then started me to think about stalking a little bit. Not that I didn't think I was stalking her, but I did. And I think this is the fledgling thriller writer perhaps in me beginning to emerge. But I was thinking about if somebody, it would be quite easy to project onto this person's words and story your own view of who and what she was. And secondly, she was sharing perhaps more than she even realised. She would talk about events, restaurants, whatever, theatres that she was going to go to. She would post photographs of herself as well, you know. And so I thought somebody, if they wanted to, could, if they perhaps had become obsessed by her even, could quite easily accidentally, in inverted commas, bump into her outside the National Opera or whatever. And also, because she would share so much about the things that she liked, you could quite easily present yourself as her perfect ideal mate, you know. And so I suppose I was thinking of the internet. I suppose that's what triggered me to think a lot about the internet and how much we do share, or many of us share, and how much of our life can be lived online, and also how you can manipulate your personality, I suppose, or the aspects of your personality that you choose to present in different social networks. I was thinking a lot about social networking because it's become so massive and so much a part of everybody, well, not everybody again, but many people's lives. Mm. I mean, I very much didn't want to write a book set in cyberspace, but I was interested in the triggers, I suppose, or the ways that the way we're living now might trigger different behaviours.
Mm. And so, of course, the book is about somebody who has an online identity and how that changes her life. It's also about addiction.
Yes, very much so. I mean, for me, it really, the addiction side of it came because I was talking to a very good friend of mine who had had some issues with addiction, not herself, but it had affected her life, shall we say. this person said to me, you know, well, you know, Steve, addiction is a very patient disease. And that really struck a chord. And I was thinking a lot about, I began to see addiction almost as this other character in a way in the book, as something that would sit there. Even this is about somebody who feels that they've been free of their addiction for many years now, but there's this idea that their addiction is really sitting there waiting to reemerge or take hold again. So yeah, it very much is about addiction.
As is writing, in a way. Are you compelled to write another book?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting one, actually. I don't think I'm addicted to anything. It's funny because, I drink, and sometimes I drink more than is good for me. And so for a long time, I've kind of been thinking, does that make me an alcoholic? When do you become an alcoholic? What's the line? Is it about how much you drink, or is it about how often you drink, or is it, you know? And then through writing this book, actually, and talking to lots of people whose lives have been touched by addiction, I've realised, I think for me, addiction is about when you use a substance or an activity as an avoidance of pain. So that's my thing. And I think perhaps if I do have an addiction, it probably is writing.
So what will you write next?
Well, I'm finishing my third book at the moment. So I'm in the editing stage. Well, perhaps it's a little bit less of an addiction, then it becomes a bit more like work. Although I'm really enjoying it, but suddenly the deadlines are looming and I feel like I'm kind of grappling the material. But yeah, I'm just finishing my third book now.
Do we have a title?
We do. It keeps changing, but I'm fairly sure it's going to be called Blackwood Bay.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to reading that. Before I Go to Sleep and Second Life by S.J. Watson, published by Chance World. They're out now. Look out for the new one. Steve, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to sound engineers Cassie Galpin and Wei Dong Ling. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.